Okay, the Senate Committee on Human Services and Rural Health Policy will come to order, and today we, in this beautiful day, I think I'll have the drapes opened. Can we have the drapes opened?
We don't.
Isn't that nice?
No, we're going to open
yes.
the drapes. I used to open them all the time. And yeah. Is there someone here who can open the drapes? Wait, Cindy, you stay here, and we'll get someone else to do that.
I'll do it.
Good.
Well, I think they're automated, sir.
You think no. they're automated?
They're automated.
They're
please.
Automated.
Yeah.
I'll get it.
I remember when we were in committee on the House side, the drapes were always open, and it was kind of nice to be distracted to look outside when, when things got boring. You could always watch the cars go by.
Okay. Oh, let there be light.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Sunshine.
Patty Whitney Wise and Sally Esselson. Okay. We're going to hear about Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force.
Coming back.
Ending hunger before it begins. Oh, well. We tried. Oh, hey.
To keep you entertained.
Well, it's kind of like the legislature can open and close. And
watch it.
Oh.
Yeah. Senator Cliff
Trowe is here. Hi, Cliff.
Oh, I didn't see you back there. How are you, Cliff?
Okay, doing well. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm Patty Whitney Wise, the director of the Oregon Hunger Task Force, and Chair Morissette and members of the committee. I appreciate you taking time to hear about our next five-year plan on ending hunger in Oregon. I want to give you just a little bit of background, and we have some people who have participated in the process who will come up and tell you a little bit about what's in it and next steps. So just to remind you that the task force was created by the legislature in 1989, and the legislature directed us to take a look at the issue of hunger in Oregon and come up with recommendations to this body as well as state agencies on improvements that could be made. We have legislators, state agencies, and nonprofits on the task force. And the first five-year plan came out about a year after Governor Kulongoski was elected. He made hunger an issue he really wanted to deal with, and we worked together with his office on putting together a five-year strategic plan. In that plan, we made progress on 30 of the 40 recommendations. So we did make some good movement forward, and I'd just like to remind you, including things like more than doubling the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program so more young people can go to college, the Healthy Kids Plan that finally passed last spring was one of the recommendations in that plan, the document recording fee that helped expand housing opportunities, consumer loans being capped at 36%. You might remember the payday loan issue from several years ago, a major investment in the temporary assistance for needy families that we're hoping to restore as we move through this recession. We've more than tripled participation in food stamps over the last 8 years. So there have been a number of very good things that have happened. And in the middle of our work on that first plan, our hunger rate did drop substantially. We moved to the middle of the states. We went from number one in hunger to about number 22. And then when the recession hit, we bumped right back down, and we're now at number two again. And what that said to us is that it is really those structural longer-term pieces that we began to work on that we need to work on even more diligently to make sure that families are stable and have the resources they need to put food on the table. So we have a lineup of people here today to talk a little bit about how the plan was developed, what's going on with hunger in Oregon at this point, and what our recommendations are. And I really, again, thank you very much for the opportunity to present this to you today.
Good afternoon. I am Sally Eliason with Partners for Hunger Free Oregon, and I am the Plan Development Coordinator. And so I just wanted to give a brief overview about the development process and what I heard and saw when I was out in Oregon. Before taking on this role, I was a director for 2 years at a food pantry and a direct service agency in rural Marion County. And when I was doing that work and hundreds of families were coming every month to visit my agency, I came to the realization that it wasn't really about how efficient our food pantry operated or how friendly the volunteers were or how what kind of produce we could offer that day. It was those types of things weren't going to solve the reasons that people were coming to our pantry. So while that was important, I came to the conclusion that I wanted to work on longer systemic changes. So when I would do the interviews with families in that position, people would talk about how they would not need to come to visit me if they could find affordable childcare, or if they could find a permanent job, or if they could get rid of their excessive medical bills. So I moved into this position and had the opportunity to travel around the state and to develop this plan, Ending Hunger Before It Begins, Oregon's Call to Action. And in that process, we administered a statewide survey. We got 385 responses from every single county in Oregon. We participated in 4 rural county community forums. We interviewed partners and community members across the state. We reviewed existing reports and data regarding hunger and health, and we hosted a statewide Hunger Leader Summit to prioritize our recommendations. And at that summit, over 100 people from all corners of the state came together to distill down the key recommendations that would land in the plan. There were representatives from the legislature, the local government, the faith community, businesses, and our own staff, partners, and other hunger advocates. So when I traveled around the state, I just wanted to highlight a few things. I heard many unique stories about particular manufacturers closing down and the number of people that now would be without health care or a living wage. And I also heard about people traveling over 75 miles to get to a full-service grocery store. And while some things were unique, it was interesting how often I heard similar stories. And I found a few common themes. And three of the themes that I wanted to highlight today is that I heard from people over and over that they want to work and they want to provide for their families. I couldn't tell you how many times I heard that statement. And the thing that is important to that is that they just need a little help to make that possible. They need to make sure that there needs to be proper training for the industries that are emerging in their area, and there needs to be the jobs that pay that living wage so that it makes sense. I also heard quite a bit about how more and more Oregonians are aware of the health impacts of the food that they're eating, and that they want to make sure that everybody in the community can benefit from those healthier foods. Gardeners, farmers, and ranchers alike that I spoke to want their food to be available in their neighborhoods, at the grocery stores, the farmers markets, at the pantries, at the hot meal sites. They want that to be spread and that healthy food to be spread around to all. And lastly, one of the most positive things I heard was how the local schools in each community could be a real hub and a real opportunity, because not only do they provide the education, but they are feeding a lot of kids. But the problems that I saw out in the really rural parts were the lack of kitchen facilities or staff to administer those federal programs or ways to reach families that didn't know how to enroll. So the process of creating this plan was really fairly enlightening for myself, and I feel like many of those themes were included in the plan. The connections that I made across Oregon were facilitated by the steering committee, and many of the steering committee members are here today, and they will expand on the areas that they gave input on throughout the plan. And you can see a full list of the committee members on the inside of the booklet. And I'm going to pass on to Mark Edwards, who was also a steering committee member.
Okay, before you pass it on. I work with a nonprofit in Springfield, and what we wanted to do is create canning facilities. Is that part
absolutely
of the plan?
Yes, we heard quite a bit about people growing food and then needing community kitchens,
yeah,
or educational opportunities for people to learn how to can their own foods. That was brought up over and over and over again.
Well, is it happening?
It is in the plan, yes.
But it's
and
not.
It.
I think Food for Lane County can address part of that when they come up, because they do provide those services, but there's a need for a lot more out there.
Okay, good. Thank you. Mark?
Yes. My name is Mark Edwards. I'm a professor at Oregon State University. I teach in the Department of Sociology and in the Rural Studies program, and I've spent the last 10 years researching issues related to hunger in Oregon. About 10 years ago, when Oregon was ranked as one of the hungriest states in the nation, I began to study carefully the data upon which that ranking was based. And I was, like many people, initially skeptical and was prepared to find that perhaps the problem wasn't as bad as some people had said. I was prepared to find that maybe there was some sort of problem with the data or the way that various people were interpreting it. Unexpectedly, my colleagues and I found that the data were, in fact, trustworthy, and we have continued to explore the best available data, how we can better understand what's going on in Oregon and the patterns and the trends and that sort of thing, particularly given that Oregon is not a place that people in the rest of the country would have thought there would be a lot of hunger. During the past decade, our incidence of hunger did decline during the first 5 years, from 2000 to 2005, and then turned around about that time and now has really surged upward. And that computes to about 95,000 households in any given year that go through this experience we call hunger or very low food security, which is the situation of having to cut the size of meals, having to cut out meals, worrying about making it to the end of the month, all of these kinds of things that you'll hear some more about today, and all for the lack of income for buying enough food for the family. The data that I use for a lot of my research comes from the same survey that is used for the calculation of our unemployment rates for the state. It's among the largest and most trusted sources of demographic information available in the U.S., and in terms of survey research, it's really considered to be state of the art. Already you're aware of the pervasive nature of the problem based on indicators you've heard about perhaps in the news and you'll hear more about today, dramatically rising caseloads for supplemental food assistance at DHS offices throughout the state and the rising demand for help at food banks. My analysis of the most recent data that has been released from the federal level shows that hunger remains high in Oregon in both rural and urban places. The data that we use come from coastal rural communities, from rural communities in the east side of the state, as well as cities of Bend, Eugene, Springfield, Medford, Salem, Kaiser, Portland, and the surrounding counties. The data show that the problem in Oregon is worst among people with few assets, renters, people with low incomes but who are above the poverty line, and people who actually have their high school diplomas but only their high school diplomas. The most sophisticated analyses done by other researchers, including some from Oregon, that take into account the characteristics of all of the lots of states and hunger rates across the country, highlight two particular issues which you'll see highlighted in the call to action to end hunger before it begins. And those two primary issues that they point out are unemployment and housing. Net of many other state characteristics, researchers have found that the peak unemployment rate in a state and the housing cost burden experienced by families are two of the main characteristics that drive hunger upwards in states. And so our volatile state economy that experiences dramatic spikes in unemployment puts Oregon households at greater risk than households in other states. Our high cost of housing relative to incomes is, especially in our larger cities, puts Oregon households at greater risk than households in other states. Right now, Oregon is ranked among the lowest states in terms of the level of assets that are held by our low-income families. And in a recent report by an independent real estate analysis firm, most of Oregon's larger cities appeared among the most overvalued housing markets in America. So again, issues of unemployment and assets and housing remain very central. Now, unemployment and asset poverty and housing costs are not the only reasons for high hunger rates in Oregon. You'll hear from others here this afternoon, and considering the recommendations in the new call to action, we address other issues as well. But what I want to point out is that the inclusion of those in the first recommendation illustrates the way that this new call to action really draws directly on data, on observations, on patterns, on trends, whether the data comes from a federal survey or the insights gained from people who've been on the ground talking to people all around the state. I was invited to participate in the steering committee from the beginning and am really confident that the most pertinent and important findings from the best available research on hunger in Oregon were central in informing the recommendations that are put forth here in this call. The committee was very attentive to making sure that the recommendations address root causes of hunger in our state.
Senator Winter.
You know, I can't. First, I'm glad you're here and doing your call to action. And I, for the record, I started Oregon Food Share in 1980. And I started it then because of a federal regulation that had been imposed nationwide that had an adverse impact on our seniors, where they disallowed medical in order for them to get assistance. And as a result, we had hunger among the elderly, and states were left with the task of how do we deal with this issue. And rather than to wait for the federal government, because it's my experience that to wait on them, we could all starve to death and die. And as so Oregon took the proactive initiative, and that's how Oregon Food Share was born. And you went back 10 years in your data assessment. I wish you'd gone back further, because I can tell you why we are where we are today. And again, it has to do with the federal piece. Those of us who knew when our income was 109% of national average rather than where we are now at about 90 or below. Oregon is a natural resource state. Oregon is a state that used to enjoy its timber harvests and its other activities, which we don't enjoy today. I was interesting to hear the rural perspective where you have towns that no longer enjoy an income. No longer do we also enjoy where the feds had promised us supplemental dollars for training and to develop businesses, and that's drying up as well. You know, it's kind of interesting because we do have to get about the business of finding jobs for our citizens. And I agree with you when you said that individuals want to work and they want to take care of their families. And I think part of our call to action is to make certain that we're talking about how do we reinvest in Oregon to create jobs. Mm-hmm. That should be a part of this whole center post that we're talking about. But I need you to put that into context. Mm-hmm. Over 50% of Oregon's land mass is federally owned. So when we start talking about our analysis of why we in Oregon are different from the rest of the 49, we have to put those into context. And I would like to see us just really push hard in a part of this discussion of call to action about the need for jobs across the state. But I do appreciate the work that you're doing and collecting the data. I would just like you to add that piece to there if you go to do further data analysis, because certainly that has had a tremendous impact on this state.
Well, and we can also, I can leave with you today a few other reports that address some of these things, because it is surprising to many people to hear some of the things like Sally commented on, that 60% of the households that have hunger, they're out working already, and there's certainly some that are not in the labor force because, you know, they're disabled or retired, but you're quite right. I think it's not merely employment, it's good employment and employment that pays, because when we studied the data from back around 2000, we found that even in Oregon, households that had full-time employees we had more hunger here among those families than we did in other states.
So I think if you took your trend line and went back to where we started having the impacts and the closures of our, particularly our rural communities, and even though we went into high tech to try to actually fill that gap, that bubble burst. So I think, you know, if your trend lines actually want to tell the story, then you may want to go a little further back than 10 years.
And Chair Morris, Senator Winters, we have a work group now that is looking further into the root causes and going back, and we'll definitely add that into the mix of the discussion. I think it's very important. I'd just like to say that we're going to do a David Letterman. We're going to start with goal three and then go to goal one because we have somebody who couldn't come till a little later. I just read the goal? Oh, go ahead.
I have a question.
I'm sorry.
Of you. The news yesterday said that of Oregon counties, Benton County had the most healthy people, Jefferson County the least healthy, Lane County was 17 on the list. How do you account for Benton County having the most healthy people?
Not because of me.
Cliff Trow's back there shaking his head, so Cliff may know the answer.
They also have the lowest.
Whenever you see a statistic about Benton County, though, you got to keep track of the large percentage of the population that are students.
The U of O is 17th healthy, but maybe it's a student body. The nature of the student body that's different. I don't know.
Chair. Benton County has always enjoyed, even in the years that I talked about, having the lowest unemployment rate in the state. Mm-hmm. If you follow the trend lines, they have always enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. They and I'm certain that our good Senator Trow out there will tell you that they live a healthy lifestyle.
I guess they do. Just look at them. Anyway. Thank you very much. Thank you. Patty, I'm interrupted.
That's all right. I just was going to read you the three goals so you know what people are talking about when they come up. We're going to start with goal three, which is improving the food assistance safety net. Okay. And then we'll talk about goal two, which is cultivating a strong regional food system in Oregon. And goal number one, which is increasing economic stability for people, communities, and the state. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to, two of our presenters will be on the phone. I'm going to call them in right now.
Okay, Karen and Villette Stockfish.
Oh. Okay, let's clear that out.
So why don't you go ahead and get started, and then we'll get them.
Bring them on in. Great. Good afternoon. My name is Karen Edmonds. I'm the Programs and Services Director at Food for Lane County. And Food for Lane County is the regional food bank for all of Lane County, Oregon, plus Harrisburg. We also service Harrisburg, which is in Linn County. And one of the beautiful parts of this plan, the five-year plan, Ending Hunger Before It Begins, is really in the overall scheme of it, it recognizes the need for public policy change and for emergency food assistance in order to approach the hunger issue from many. And so it works on strengthening hunger relief, the immediate need that we see every day, but it also focuses on what causes hunger. What are those root causes, the things that are further upstream? So overall, from a food bank perspective, we think it really blends those two very well and very nicely, and it's a really comprehensive plan in that way. Because that's the need for emergency food assistance. We see it every day, but yet we wish it wasn't there. I mean, we're really proud of what we do. And somebody has changed their number in the last 24 hours. They really wanted out of this commitment. So coming from a food bank, we're just very, very pleased to participate in the development of this plan that we believe does approach the hunger issue from multifaceted levels. One of the ways that we see the faces of hunger is at our food pantries, and that's where people do receive emergency food assistance, a 3 to 5 day supply of groceries to help them get by. And there's a woman who talked to us recently. Her name is Nina, and she's a mother, and she has her husband was a machinist, had worked as a machinist all of his life. And after three back surgeries, the last one rendered him disabled, so he was unable to work. And they had also had a son with Down syndrome. So as a result, she found herself going back to work. She did find a part-time job, but between the job and his disability payments, they just couldn't make ends meet. And so she went to her local food pantry, which is in Crow, which is right to the west of Eugene, and it's at a church, the Crow Church of the Nazarene. And she says, you know, it's not the coming here that's hard. She says, I'm a member of this church. I've been a donor to the food pantry. It's not the coming that's hard. It's being in this position that's hard. She'd always seen herself as a donor, the person giving the food when the call to action came. And suddenly she found herself in the position needing to ask for the assistance. So that's one of the things we'd like to do, is remove that stigma of asking for assistance and realize there are people out like Nina all over the county that are in immediate need, and that's what we're here for. That's what we're here, to provide that immediate need, that safety net. So goal number three is to improve the food assistance safety net. And there's three major important parts to know about goal three. So it's three for three. One element of goal three is strengthening all of those services and programs that make up the safety net. So that consists of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. It includes women, infants, and children. It includes the emergency food assistance providers that are part of the Oregon Food Bank Network. It includes the faith-based communities, the food pantries, the meal sites, the shelters, all of the places where people can access emergency food and food assistance. So by strengthening all of those, it becomes truly a net. So it's not just one, it's not a safety cord, but it's a safety net, and we all work together to be able to provide diverse means of access to food for people that need it, right when they need it, at the time they need it. A second aspect of Goal 3 is improving access to underserved populations. And that has to do with really putting a flashlight on ourselves and saying, how are we providing service and who are we missing? At Food for Lane County, we've been really, really pleased with the work that we've been able to do in a multicultural outreach initiative. So we took a look and we saw that the Latino population in our community was growing. It was the fastest growing group. 11% of Latinos in Lane County lived at poverty level, but only 6% of our pantry clients identified as Latino. And so we knew that the Latino population wasn't accessing the service as often as they could. And so we took a look at how do we better serve this population that isn't being served right now. And we had a very successful campaign with our summer food program that provides free lunch for kids in the summer. And that we did some very specific targeted ads. We had a Spanish radio ad, a Spanish TV ad, bilingual bus ads. And as a result, we saw the participation of Latino students in our summer food program grow 46% over the previous summer. So it was very significant. The calls into the front desk asking about summer food program in Spanish quadrupled over the previous summer. So we really, really were encouraged by this, and we know that doing specific outreach can really help bring those underserved populations in, and by us doing things differently to be able to provide services. So that was a really key component of improving the food assistance safety net, too, is reaching underserved populations, be that the seniors in their county, different people of color, disabled, homebound, people who might not be able to access emergency food. The third element of Goal 3 is strengthening support for federal programs. And again, Food for Lane County is a sponsor of the Summer Food Program, which is actually a USDA program. It's run through the federal government. And we are a sponsor in the summer, so we're able to provide meals for students, actually kids aged 2 to 18, who during the school year can access the National School Lunch Program on free and reduced lunch. But in the summer, they're left without that resource. So the Summer Food Program kicks in only when the National School Lunch Program isn't able to operate. And Food for Lane County operates the largest summer food program in the state. We actually have 60 sites last year, and we're looking at 65 this year. And we see it as really a strength that we can have a federal program in our county, not only for the children that it serves. It served 140,000 meals last summer, so there's a significant number of our children in our county who are served by the program. But also in terms of the local economy, we made $158,000 worth of food purchases, and those went to a local dairy for the milk. It went to the local fruit and produce distributor and the local wholesale food distributor. So by bringing in the federal dollars, we're also able to help our local economy. So we'd like to see part of that food assistance safety net strengthening the support for those federal programs that help the local economy in a lot of ways. So those are the three main elements of goal number three of improving the food assistance safety net. It's strengthening that safety net, improving the access to underserved populations, and also strengthening the support for federal programs. So we can help people like Nina when they need it, and we can also help people have to prevent that awkward position of being in that church asking for food when they never thought they would have to be there. So we're helping to prevent it and be there when people need it at the same time.
Do we have canning kitchens in Lane County?
To get back to your question, we have been looking into that at Food for Lane County. There used to be 9 canneries in the Willamette Valley, and we currently don't have any. And so at Food for Lane County, we've thought about canning food that's donated to us to be able to preserve its shelf life longer.
Well, gleaning is something that people do in the fall. And
exactly.
But what do they do with the food when they get it is the question.
Right now, they donate it, and it's distributed as a perishable product.
Yeah.
So it's highly perishable. It goes out to the food pantries, but it needs to be turned around and used very quickly. So by canning or somehow expanding the life of the food, we could work on that. We've actually explored a partnership with the cannery in, starting the initial conversations, the cannery that is in Salem. Truett Brothers is one we've talked about. Yeah, we have a good donor relationship with them now, and it's one thing that's bubbled up that we've been talking about in terms of perhaps being able to can the food that is donated.
Yeah. The nonprofit that I was involved in actually owned the building that that Catholic Community Services is in now in Springfield, and that's what we wanted to do, is have a place where people could come and learn how to can and actually have the big pressure cookers and so on. I think that's really, really, if you can do it, that would be great.
If we can do it, right. We also,
Mr. Chair, Truett Brothers actually is a huge cannery, and they have donated as a substantial amount of foods and stuff to the food banks.
Yeah.
But well, I think your idea of having
if people learn how people to do that and can do it on their own, that's another step in self-sufficiency.
Sure, it is. It is.
Huh? I learned how to can.
All right.
So did I.
Freeze, too.
I used to help my mother.
I'll put in a plug, too. Actually, the Oregon State University Extension Office does a large piece of the nutrition education programs in terms of teaching people to can.
I hope they stay around.
We do, too.
Thank you.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, I'm Belit Stockleth. I'm the program manager for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program within the Department of Human Services, Children's and Adult and Families. And DHS has been long engaged in efforts to reduce hunger in Oregon through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. This effort includes a strong partnership with the Oregon Hunger Task Force. And this plan, this most recent plan, is a more focused effort to reduce hunger in Oregon. I'm here today to describe the how the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program plays an integral role in the plan. You know, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, long name now, we used to be easy, the purpose of the program is to supplement a family's food budget. It's not meant to be the entire food budget. And many times and in many instances with these families, they use the entire food stamp allotment or SNAP allotment as their entire food budget for the month. In most instances, that allotment does not last through the month. It's not meant to last throughout the month, which, you know, is why we have to work in partnership to try to help these folks. The program has experienced tremendous growth over the past 2 years. Since December 2007, there's been a 53.5% increase in the households receiving the program benefits. As you know, due to the economic downturn, we're seeing many more folks than we have in the past, many families that have never had to experience receiving assistance. In January 2010, there was 683,661 individuals receiving benefits, which is a 27.8% increase over a year ago. And this represents approximately $87 million in total benefits. Even with, you know, even though we've realized this drastic growth in need, there are still, within this program, there's still many more people that could be receiving benefits who are not. One of the populations nationally that we have, and in Oregon, that we have a hard time reaching are the senior population. And, you know, it's through our partnerships and our outreach that we will continue to reach out to these folks and try to bring them in and bring awareness to this program. You know, all of our efforts, you know, are really focused on easing access as well. Thank you for letting me. Do you have any questions?
Yeah, sorry. Thank you. Those are really interesting statistics.
Well, we know that, and it's historic, that when we're in a high level of unemployment that we are now, the needs go up dramatically. We know that, you know, my earlier comments about employment and jobs and where we don't have enough, and when I say living wage, I mean it's higher than the minimum wage that we have. We know that there is a need for supplemental services, those things that we know. And, you know, I said earlier that there was a period of time in history when Oregon was blessed to enjoy 109% of the average national wage. And so now when we're a lot lower than that, we know that that's problematic both in the terms of nutrition as well as housing and some of the other things that are safety nets that we need. I don't know about you, but it breaks my heart to think that Oregon is at this place. You know, it's nothing that I don't think any of us, either on this panel or in this room, want to be proud of. And I see my good friend back there in the back bobbing his head, and I know one of the ladies that I've worked with for a long time who's sitting back there in pink would agree. And so, you know, it's an issue that we really do seriously, that this body and as a state, you know, need to come to grips with, that we really do need to make certain that people could become self-reliant. And that's kind of all. I'm glad that you're there to help, but it's one of these issues that I think, and your call to action is good. I still want to say that we focus on making certain that we have people employed. I know we have people who've been on the unemployment for over a year or more. So the seniors, that seniors don't like to be helped, as you know. We're very tough and self-reliant and independent, and we don't want anybody to actually give us the handout. I had that when we started Oregon Food Share, and when you had seniors who were actually eating dog food because of where we were, and it's that total self-reliance position that they're in, and that's a tough one to get to that population group, because it's their dignity and their pride that's there. So I commend for what you're doing. Don't like the position that we're in, but I'm glad that you're there to do it. So.
Okay, thank you very much. Sharon, you can come up, and we're going to have two people on the phone, I hope.
Yeah.
Yes, I hope so too. Yeah.
Southeast Oregon Regional Food Bank. This is Peter.
Hi, Peter. This is Sandy with the Senate Human Services and Rural Health Policy. Is Pastor James there?
He is. Let me put you on speakerphone.
Great.
Sandy?
Yes.
Okay.
Hear you. Okay, good. You're before the entire committee in the audience, so you are live.
Go ahead and introduce yourselves, please.
My name is Peter Lawson. I'm the branch coordinator for the Southeast Oregon Regional Food Bank.
Okay, welcome.
My name is James Allgaard, and I'm a Lutheran pastor in town in Ontario. I also serve on the board for a local community food pantry, the Next Chapter Food Pantry. We have two sites in town.
Oh. My daughter lives in Ontario, and her family, so.
Oh, great.
Okay, so go ahead.
No, Pastor James, you can give your presentation if you'd like. We're still on goal number three for the committee.
And this is about the emergency food distribution.
Or the safety net.
Right.
I think we're still on the safety net, and then we'll be moving into the regional food system, if you don't mind.
Yes, okay.
Thank you.
I do have just a few brief comments about our food pantries. We have two sites, as I mentioned, and we were established in January of 2006. There are about 10 congregations involved, and some individuals from the congregation, as well as several organizations and businesses. And so we've really taken the issue of food security in our community head on and have really made an effort to meet people's needs. And we see it as a faith response, really, is being neighbors in our community. There are a few numbers that I compiled for 2009. Am I doing okay on time?
Yes.
Okay. In 2009, our pantries served 1,457 households at least once during the year. And if the average household size is four persons, you take that 1,457 and multiply it times four, and that means 5,828 individuals were helped by our organization in 2009. And for those of you who may be curious, the population of Ontario is just shy of 11,000. So that equals about 47% of Ontario's population walk through our doors at least once. And when they come to our food pantries, they would receive emergency food such as rice and beans, canned products, boxed meals, fresh produce, some produce that we call Fresh Alliance, which is actually a partnership with local grocers like Albertsons. And this food box would ideally support a family for as many as 5 days, but more like 3 days. We received 299,000 pounds of food through our regional food bank during 2009, 299,000 pounds. And this does not include other donations that were received by our pantry, such as garden produce and canned food drives from our local congregations. I just didn't have that figure in front of me, so I apologize. Let's see. I think the most important figure that I had in front of me was how many households we served in 2009. And for me, it's been a real eye-opener. I grew up in Minnesota, a son of a farmer, and so food security was never an issue that was in front of me. And so when I came to Eastern Oregon and began my professional life, this really was quite an eye-opener to see how many households in our community are really struggling to just meet those day-to-day needs. It's been good to get testimonials back from our clients as well. I've been trying to send out some newsletters to our constituency, sharing some of that personal side of what we're able to do to help families just to get by from day to day and month to month.
Now, you're the pastor of, did you say the Lutheran Church?
Yeah. There are two Lutheran congregations here, and I'm pastor of one of them. Yep.
Now, my daughter and her husband, her family belong to the Catholic, I forget the name of the church there.
That's
Blessed Sacrament. Yes. Are other churches involved as well, the congregations?
Yeah, actually, our congregation is one of about 10 faith communities that are together in these pantries.
Okay.
I'd like to also mention that the Catholic Church has been operating a food pantry for many years, and they've been self-supporting, and only just recently have they begun a partnership with the regional food bank, which we're really thankful for. It's great that the regional food bank can also support what they're doing.
Okay. Good. Okay. Thank you very much.
Sure. I hope that I addressed the right kind of information.
Oh, I think that's... Yeah, yes, I think you have. Any other questions, comments?
Okay,
thank you. And so, Pastor Peter... you're Peter Lawton.
Yes.
Yeah. Branch manager.
I only hear the sermon at this moment.
Okay. Sorry about that. Okay, identify yourself and your location and the name of your...
Peter Lawton. I am the branch coordinator for Southeast Oregon Regional Food Bank,
okay,
which is a program of Oregon Food Bank.
And Peter, Sharon is at the table to cover your goal 2 discussion along with you.
Fantastic.
Okay.
Now, Southeast Oregon is where?
Ontario, Oregon, and we serve and supply pantries and allied agencies in Malheur and Harney counties.
Okay, good. Okay.
And to that end, we supply 6 emergency food pantries and 14 allied efforts, which include... community meal sites, summer lunch programs. We also supply the supplemental efforts of family counseling center, a domestic abuse shelter, and a number of others, including also a Boys and Girls Club.
Do you have Meals on Wheels? Is that part of it?
Meals on Wheels does exist within the community. It's not a program that we supply directly.
Okay.
And just as another statistic, we are moving approximately 744,000 pounds through the system. That's what we did in 2009. And so getting to the piece with reference to a strong regional food system, we have two things that I'd like to present along that lines. One is that we actually have an individual in our office who is working on putting together a local food guide and expanding the dialogue in this region in particular of local foods access, local foods as a mechanism for economic development, and so on and so forth. And the reason that I missed your call earlier was that we actually had a gentleman that had called in that wanted to be included within that local food guide. And so that was an element. Another anecdotal story about the regional food system, we were contacted last spring by a rancher in the Harney County area who wanted, with some of his colleagues, to put together a rather large contribution. Approximately, when it was all said and done, about 20,000 pounds of ground beef that these folks ended up donating. But the only way that, or the only area that they could have that had the capacity at that time to process all this beef was actually in Nampa, Idaho. So you had some folks in Burns shipping about 30 head of live cattle to Nampa, Idaho, to have it come back to meet some needs in Southeast Oregon, and then we had enough supply that we were able to then share with our colleagues in the Oregon Food Bank Network. And so here you have product going from Eastern Oregon to Idaho, back to Eastern Oregon, back to the west side, and then out again throughout the state. which is really a tremendous effort, and we had a lot of partners there. But it also highlights some of the capacity issues that some of these regional producers run into from time to time.
Okay. Senator Winters has a question.
Sure.
Because you're so close to the Idaho border, are there other areas where you do cooperate with each other? I always think about potatoes, but I know you're close enough to the border. That does the regional boundaries go over into Idaho?
We really, as an organization, we really focus in on the needs of Oregonians, just because that's the USDA mandate, and obviously with respect to a lot of the donors. That said, we do have a strong relationship, and we continue to work on the relationship with our colleagues on Idaho Food Bank. And we do also have a couple of mechanisms. Again, just by the proximity, there are some of the agencies. So, for instance, Boys and Girls Club was one of the programs that we supply with healthy snacks. And they do serve a mix of Oregon and Idaho kids. And our community meal site really doesn't make that border distinction, and that is a program that we supply.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Okay. We're kind of limited in time. Do you have other comments that you would like to make?
I think one of the key things for us in hearing Pastor Augard is that we've really tried to focus in on collaboration is a strong piece of what helps us get things done, and just communication with our allied efforts and an ongoing educational piece as well, really focusing in not only on meeting the immediate needs, but on continuing to provide information, outreach, and expand the conversation about root causes as well.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, go ahead.
You might not be surprised to know that in eastern Oregon, self-sufficiency and the pioneering spirit is pretty strong. And so as an organization, our food pantries know that we're putting a pretty small Band-Aid on a chronic issue, and we'd love to be able to work ourselves out of business, really, in a sense, and that is to be part of a system that helps people learn a little bit more about self-sufficiency, and I know that there's another conversation about economics, and it's a real big picture issue for us, but we're making efforts in the areas of education, providing recipes, and someday soon I hope to do a crock pot drive so that our clients can have crock pots to use. You know, things like that really help them to have even just a little leg up on their day-to-day life.
And so I think, the last element of that in closing is just to say that we've been really glad to be able to participate in the formation of this next five-year strategy and really feel that, hey, these are all things that we're currently working on and plan to continue working on.
Thank you very much. I will tell Representative Cliff Bentz that we've had this conversation. Cliff is a law partner with my son-in-law, Tim Helfrich, in Ontario, and so...
Yes, actually, both Tim and Cliff have been long-term friends and mentors of mine.
Okay, good. Well, good to hear that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Sharon, would you like to...
Yes. Thank you, Senator Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Sharon Thornberry. I'm the community resource developer for Oregon Food Bank. I think David Sarasan has best described my job as the circuit rider for Oregon Food Bank in rural Oregon. I spend a lot of time and have spent a great deal of time in eastern Oregon. A little over 5 years ago, there was one food pantry that served all of Malheur County, and now Peter has described to you the efforts that have expanded out there, and that was my assignment, was to help reorganize that system. And in doing that and in working in other parts of rural Oregon, I've learned a great deal about what the challenges are for Oregonians that live throughout our state and in those rural spaces. We live in one of the most bountiful food production regions of the world, and yet we have hunger and food insecurity. And not just for low-income Oregonians. Rural residents are driving 60 to 100, sometimes more miles, to access a full-service grocery store. The rural stores that once supplied their needs cannot get wholesale deliveries of groceries, especially perishables. They drive even greater distances than their customers to reach a wholesale source that can supply them. These are the same communities where an abundance of food is produced but cannot be processed. You can buy JoJo's and chicken strips in many ranching communities, but you will be challenged to purchase a locally grown burger and fries in most of them, even though we produce tons of potatoes and beef. In some rural communities, the best grocery store in town is the emergency food pantry. The increased distance to food access provides multiple challenges to low-income, disabled, and elderly residents. Inner-city neighborhoods face the same face different but similar challenges in gaining access to healthy food in neighborhoods populated with convenience stores and fast food establishments. The Oregon Food Bank is partnering with partners around the state, supported by the RARE program at the University of Oregon, is engaged in community food assessments, one of which Peter mentioned, including surveys of rural grocers in 12 counties in the state. Six AmeriCorps participants are inventorying food systems, conducting community meetings, organizing local community foods groups, and building a picture of what is really going on in Oregon's rural communities. They are identifying strengths and documenting challenges and opportunities that face Oregonians seeking access to healthy food or wishing to produce, process, and retail food in their own communities. Other organizations are or have undertaken similar efforts in many other parts of Oregon, and it is our hope to cover many more of the remote regions of the state in the coming year. Goal 2 of Ending Hunger Before It Begins provides a guide for our future work in Oregon. Across Oregon, many hardworking individuals, organizations, and businesses are working to rethink and reframe Oregon's food system for good of all its residents. I hope you'll have the opportunity to familiarize yourself with these efforts in your area. But one of the missing links is a means to bring forward the policy needs that are identified in these efforts. A state food policy council is described in this plan, and Highlight 2 could provide that means. I'd like to take just a couple of minutes to talk about some of the things, questions that you brought forward. Senator Moore said, in terms of canning kitchens, in the 1980s, Senator Winters well remembers, we had community canning kitchens spread across the state. They were part of the war on poverty. At that same time, gleaning groups were started. In 1986, I was hired to work with gleaning programs in Lynn and Benton County and worked there for 12 years until an equal amount of years ago, I came to work for Oregon Food Bank. And those canning kitchens provided a place for people who didn't have the facilities or the skills to learn either in classes or from each other about food preservation. We can recover that system again. It can happen again, and there are ways to do it. Food safety is a much bigger issue today than it was then. And there also, I think, that we need to look at drying as another kind of food preservation that we could encourage people to do. There are programs, Jammin' for the Hungry, which is done at the First United Methodist Church in Corvallis, gleans fruits from all over the valley area there. They freeze them, and then they have volunteer jammin' sessions where they make jam, and they've licensed that facility with a USDA licensing so that they can actually distribute those jams and jellies in food pantries and at soup kitchens. And they make a huge amount of low sugar or no sugar jams and jellies to address the needs of diabetics, because we, as anybody who knows the emergency food system well knows, we have tons of peanut butter, but very few jams and jellies to go with it, and yet we have an abundance of fruit.
I'm just learning how to make jam without sugar and using Splenda and other kinds of things. And it's
there are special pectins to do that with. And there's actually one pectin that you can use with or without sugar, and that's what they use at my church in Corvallis.
And it is called?
You know what? I'll get the name for you. I'll get it for you.
okay. Yeah, we're going to have committee meetings coming up here pretty soon.
Okay. All right. That's all part of a program called the Interfaith Food and Farming Partnership. And just for your, because I'm a longtime resident of Benton County, and to answer your curiosity question, I think that Benton County, it's a small land mass. It has a very, if you look at the educational levels, they're very high there because of the university and the main employers there. It's all about research, and, I mean, the average receptionist in Corvallis has at least a bachelor's degree. And that's been well documented for over 20 years now. But once you get to the rural communities of Benton County, the story is not the same, and people are not food secure, and poverty is an issue. But in terms of low-income people, there are efforts like the Interfaith Food and Farming Partnership. Community Services Consortium has run a gleaning program for low-income people consistently for over 25, well, actually 30 years there. I think that it's about access. People have access to food, and there's a very vibrant local food economy there that employs people in the local food economy and makes food, that local food, available to people in the community. And therefore, that leads to increased health. And we can replicate that kind of a vibrant local food economy across the state if we think about it. But we have to, we've just sort of turned over responsibility, and all the processing has left our state, and we don't have a place to even process our own beef and be able to sell it back to our neighbors. And we have to rethink that. And so those are things that I think are really important. And I hope that in the future, when we have the reports from the AmeriCorps volunteers, and we brought that all together, we'll be able to come back to this committee and give you some of our recommendations and tell you that story.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very, very much. Okay, Jessica, Lee, and Janet. Who wants to start?
James and Peter, are you still on the line?
Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, do you want to stay on the line for the next presentation? Or do you want to go?
Either way, we're
under a time crunch because we have some committees that start at 3, and we need to get out of here a little bit before 3, so.
Okay.
Who's up?
I'm up first.
Okay.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Jessica Cheney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Partners for Hunger Free Oregon. Also, incidentally, used to work at Food for Lane County for a number of years, so I have a grounding in the emergency food side of things, and now I work more on public policies with Partners for Hunger Free Oregon and the Oregon Hunger Task Force. I'm going to give a brief overview of the approach and thinking behind Goal 1 of the plan. However, before I do that, I just wanted to touch on a few of the health impacts of hunger and food insecurity and the implications for individual Oregonians and their families, as well as our local communities and the state. Oregon's Childhood Hunger Coalition, which is a group composed of healthcare providers, educators, and nonprofit organizations, has focused on creating a continuing education module for healthcare providers in our state. This is designed to encourage them to screen for indications of childhood hunger and food insecurity, and then to refer those families to resources such as WIC and SNAP. The module is online. It's available to the public, but the information on that website is definitely a wake-up call for all of us. Hunger and food insecurity has become a public health concern, and I wanted to take a moment to highlight a few of the statistics that are from their website. For instance, children who live in food insufficient households experience impairments in 4 key areas: to their physical health, to their emotional and psychological well-being, to their academic achievement, and with their social relationships with their family and their peers. Just first, the physical health. We know that children that are in food insecure households, there's problems right from the beginning in prenatal growth, fetal development, and the birth outcomes. They have more upper respiratory infections, in fact, 57% more among ages 1 to 5 years. They have more hospitalizations, 30% more. There's an inadequate intake of protein and vitamin A and magnesium in those households, particularly among adolescents. They also have a higher incidence of iron deficiency anemia. It's 140% higher for infants and toddlers in those food insecure households. And they found that during the first 2 years of life, there is an established correlation between iron deficiency anemia and impairments in cognitive, mental, and psychomotor development. Those are just the physical side of things. In the emotional psychological realm, we know that those children experience more frustration, worry, and sadness, behavioral problems such as aggression, inattention, irritability, and hyperactivity. Teens are more likely to be depressed, and they're 5 times more likely to try to commit suicide. Along with their intellectual achievement, the World Health Organization has identified the level of education as among the strongest predictors of a person's health status. And school readiness, of course, includes physical, social, and emotional development. Kindergartners in food insecure households had impaired academic performance in both reading and mathematics. Children ages 6 to 11 years had significantly lower arithmetic scores. They were more likely to have repeated a grade, had higher rates of absenteeism, tardiness, and school suspension. Finally, their social relationships among their family and peers. Children in these households between 6 and 16 years were 74% more likely to be socially disruptive, and they had difficulty getting along with their peers. These are just a few of the statistics that are available to us that demonstrate the devastating impacts of hunger and food insecurity for children. And it's important to note that that also affects their families, their classmates, the teaching environment in school, and their future ability to succeed and do well as adults. Hunger also affects other populations, particularly people with disabilities and senior citizens. Research has shown that seniors that do not get adequate nutrition can show signs of dementia or Alzheimer's when they are really undernourished. This affects their diagnosis and their treatment. Undernutrition can also cause decreased cognitive functioning, leading to more falling injuries, and that can put them in walkers, wheelchairs, and nursing homes. We are still learning all the impacts of hunger, but what we do know, is very compelling. As a society, we take steps to protect the public health, such as ensuring that students get inoculated or organizing to minimize the effects of pandemics such as the H1N1 virus. However, we have not yet mobilized in the same fashion to prevent the dire effects of hunger and food insecurity. We know that it also costs our state significant resources over the long term. We pay through lowered academic outcomes, reduced economic productivity, hunger-related illnesses that require treatment, and also larger investments in our food assistance programs, which we've heard today. One of the most effective ways of preventing all of these bad outcomes is to go upstream, to focus on the root causes of hunger, and that is what Goal 1 of the plan is all about. The key theme for Goal 1 is stability. That's economic stability, both for the families that needed economic stability, for communities in our state, as well as the state as a whole. For individual Oregonians, this is accomplished by providing opportunities for them to acquire employment, that pays a living wage so they can cover all of their basic needs, housing, utilities, food, childcare, and also provide them with benefits that protect and support them over time, such as health care coverage and retirement. That is why you will see items within Goal 1 that promote affordable housing, educational opportunities, affordable child care, health care coverage, tax credits, paid family leave insurance program. These are the tools that Oregonians need to make ends meet and to put good, nutritious food on their table every single day. It will also allow them to save for emergencies so they are less vulnerable when an economic crisis hits. We want the same economic stability for local communities as well as the state as a whole, which means that we need a stable revenue stream and adequate savings. That is why we've included strengthening a reserve system, such as through the Rainy Day Fund, to protect our state when times are tough. The recent recession and many other recessions have shown us that our state is particularly vulnerable to economic swings. It is often said that when the nation gets a cold, Oregon gets pneumonia. Our state will continue to be in that make ends meet place, just like many Oregon families, until we focus on creating more long-term stability. So I'm going to turn it over to Lee Mercer from the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and he's going to talk about one of the items that are in Goal 1, which is the expanding the Oregon Earned Income Tax Credit.
Thank
you. We have 10 minutes left.
Okay. My name's Lee Mercer, and for the sake of brevity, I'll just make a few comments, and the rest is in my testimony. I'm with the Oregon Center for Public Policy and do education and outreach. It was found in the last hunger study that hunger is an income issue. It makes sense. Senator Winter was making that point. And, of course, we need jobs in Oregon to feed hungry people. But 46% of the people served by the food bank are working families. So working families are not making ends meet. The current plan reflects this insight in its recommendations to increase economic stability for people's community and the state. For as important as the efforts of food banks and government food programs are, the key to preventing hunger rests in achieving economic stability for Oregon families. This is why the report's recommendation to reform Oregon's tax system so it is stable, fair, and sustainable comes into play. Oregon is one of the minority of states that tax the income of families living below the poverty line despite their work effort. By taxing the wages of poor working families, we make it that much harder for them to get ahead. The most efficient and targeted way for Oregon to raise the income tax threshold and end the practice of taxing the work effort of the poor is to boost the state's earned income tax credit, or EITC. The EITC has had a long history of bipartisan support on the national and the state level as an effective anti-poverty policy. Oregon's current EITC is calculated at 6% of the federal credit, making it one of the smallest credits among the 24 states that provide an EITC. Raising Oregon's earned income tax credit to 18% of the federal credit, as proposed under SB 1044 in this session, would ensure that most working poor parents in Oregon would be no longer pay income taxes on their work effort. For a family of four living at the poverty line with about $22,000 in income, such an increase would mean about $580 more a year.
Time out. Where is SB?
It's in the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. It has been heard, and that's where it is.
So are we going to see that?
We hope you do.
Good.
Yeah. Boosting the state EITC would directly benefit over 220,000 working families. In the five districts represented by this committee, the federal EITC brings in $71 million in the year 2006. So it's a considerable local community economic impact as well, the EITC. So for these reasons, we'd like to see you, as legislators, take action on the recommendations of this hunger plan. The two pieces that you could take action on now would be to support and move the SB 1044 now in the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. And you've received a memo, all the legislators have received a memo, on reaching out to your constituents and letting them know about free tax preparation services by AARP, Tax Aid, and other groups, so that the people that get earned income tax credit and other family-friendly credits will get those credits and get that extra income in, and you'll help with the fight against hunger. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for that information, and I will talk to the chair of the Revenue Committee today.
Mm-hmm. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird, and I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships. Neighborhood Partnerships is a statewide organization that manages a number of collaborative efforts that work to affect systems change and policy change that move people out of poverty and into a place of financial stability and resiliency. We have worked closely through the Housing Alliance, which is one of our efforts, with the Hunger Task Force since about 2004, when hunger was found to be a primary, unaffordable housing was found to be a primary source of hunger. And we began to work together in close alliance on the root causes of hunger and meeting some of those through meeting the needs of Oregonians for affordable housing. We have made quite a bit of progress on the affordable housing issue. However, we know that, for example, there were 18,000 school children in the state of Oregon who were homeless during some part of the last school year. We know that with the economic downturn, in spite of the stimulus money that goes into short-term rent assistance, those numbers are going to go up again with the evictions and the foreclosures that are happening every day throughout Oregon's communities. In addition to our focus on housing, Neighborhood Partnerships also works to create opportunities for low-income individuals and families to be financially resilient and independent. And I've shared with you a document that was put out by the Corporation for Enterprise Development that we had the opportunity to partner on this past fall. And I shared that with you in part because it really exemplifies the kind of approach that's incorporated in Goal 1 of the Hunger Plan. It looks at these issues of hunger and housing and jobs and income, earned income tax credits, as interwoven and interlinked. And a number of us organizationally and individually have started to really work together in partnership to address these issues. The graph on the front page of the document that I passed out illustrates an indicator known as asset poverty. And asset poverty is a measure of how many people couldn't survive 3 months at the federal poverty level if their major source of income was lost. And, you know, of course, people at the lowest end of the economic spectrum couldn't survive if they didn't receive their TANF benefits or their unemployment benefits. What's really striking is how many people in the middle income spectrums couldn't survive for 3 months if their income was lost. And we see that as really indicative of the need to create the kind of financial resiliency that the policies that are talked about in Goal 1 of the Hunger Plan talk about. Personal assets are needed, like basic education, job training, access to employment, and then folks need to have the ability to create financial reserves, an emergency fund for those things that happen in life, and then eventually equity in a home, the kinds of assets that can help people start to plan for the future and really prepare their children for the future.
Now, one of the difficult things about talking about the cost shift, which we're talking about, is that it's hard to get your arms around how much it's going to cost our society if people have to go to institutions, the emergency room, to hospitals, to prisons, to mental health institutions because of the situation they find themselves in. That is a huge cost shift. If they go to a nursing home and the state has to pay, you know, $6,000, not the state only, but the feds. And we got to talk about cost shift, too. We have to try to get that idea across. But it's an intangible and it's a negative. How do you prove a negative? It's hard to prove a negative, but that's what it amounts to. We're going to pay more if we don't do something. And we have to provide healthy food and all of the kinds of things that we're talking about. We're going to have to end. We have another meeting at 3 o'clock, and both of us have to go back and get our stuff and right here. But we have to go.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being here.
We can have them back in the air.
Yeah, right, yes. And when is the main report going to be ready?
Next week.
Okay.
You have a copy.
Okay. Well, we can
preview.
We can have you back. We'll have you back later because this is something that I think needs to be discussed. And we will talk about that. Thank you for the information because I will talk to Senator Devlin.
And Rosen.
And Rosen, yes, indeed.
Sponsored.
We are adjourned. Thank you.
Sorry.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.